Welcome to another episode of The Americans. I'm happy to have you all here. For all of you who don't know me yet, I'm Chelsea Speaker, originally from upstate New York, now in Berlin. And this is the Transatlantic Podcast on what's going on in my home country, America. A lot has happened over the past weeks, and it's all culminated so far in President Trump having become infected with the coronavirus.
President Trump just tweeted moments ago that he and the First Lady have tested positive for the coronavirus.
I want to begin by thanking all of the incredible medical professionals for the incredible job they've been doing. We have things happening that look like they're miracles coming down from God.
Breaking news tonight, the president, who has coronavirus, leaving isolation to wave to supporters from an SUV, ignoring public health guidelines. This after his doctor revealed earlier his blood oxygen level dropped twice in the past 2 days. Questions tonight about why the president's team didn't reveal that information earlier.
The news about his infection has almost made us forget that embarrassment of a TV debate between Trump and Biden just a few days prior. It's still hard to find the right words to describe what we saw there.
We had an avalanche of lying from President Trump.
I'm not here to call out his lies. Everybody knows he's a liar.
But you
I just
agree.
Want to make
you're
sure.
The liar.
I want to make sure.
Glad you ordered last in your class, not first in your class.
I want to make
Mr.
sure.
Mr. President, can you let him finish, sir?
No, he doesn't know how to do that.
With you,
go ahead.
You
get the wait a minute. You get the final word, Mr.
Well, it's hard to get any word in with this clown.
But it wasn't all about Trump and Biden. We had to say goodbye to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, one of the strongest voices for gender equality and civil rights in the United States.
We are coming on the air at this hour because CBS News has confirmed that Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has died at the age of 87 from complications from metastatic pancreatic cancer.
It has been said that Ruth wanted to be an opera virtuoso, but became a rock star instead. But she chose the law. Subjected to discrimination in law school and the job market because she was a woman, Ruth would grow to become the leading advocate fighting such discrimination in court. Among the words that best describe Ruth, tough, brave, a fighter, a winner, but also thoughtful, careful, compassionate, honest. And yet, still, Ruth is gone, and we grieve.
I still remember one of the rare interviews she gave just a few years back. She was asked what questions she's most often asked.
One question is, did you always want to be a judge? I try to explain the way things were in the not so good old days. So when I graduated from law school in 1959, there was not a single woman on any federal bench. It would not be a realistic ambition for a woman to want to become a federal judge. So I am determined to appoint members of minority groups and women in numbers to the federal bench. So we will use the talent of all of the people of the United States and not just some of them.
Let's now move on to my guest today, who brings us back to the pandemic and the issue of the condition of the U.S. healthcare system. I spoke with Yale professor Timothy Snyder, who became painfully aware of the critical state of the ailing American healthcare system when he himself was in need of urgent medical attention.
We shouldn't be in a situation where people can't afford to go to the hospital. We shouldn't be in a situation where there's silent privilege for some people over others. And I guess, I mean, personally, it's a simple, banal thing, but I realize that this kills you. This can kill people. I almost died, and I wouldn't have almost died. It wouldn't have even been a close call if I'd been in other countries where I lived before.
Timothy Snyder is an award-winning author and historian currently teaching at Yale University. What he experienced just a few months back and discovered in the aftermath was turned into a book called Our Malady, Lessons in Liberty from a Hospital Diary. It begins just a few days before the end of 2019. Snyder was in Germany when he fell gravely ill. Back in the United States, he ended up clinging to life for months before finally getting better in spring of this year. Since this time, he maintains that, quote, health is not recognized in America as a human right, and America's coronavirus response is an urgent call to rethink health and freedom. I started the conversation on a more general note, since Timothy Snyder is also a highly respected political expert in both Europe and the United States.
Tim, it's really nice to talk to you today.
My pleasure. Very glad we can do it.
It seems pretty obvious that 2020 is a really decisive year economically and socially because of the pandemic, of course, and politically because of what's happening with U.S. elections coming up, technologically because of the digital push, and you see it on both sides of the Atlantic. How do you see the U.S., but also Europe, and in particular Germany, moving forward?
Well, I guess the first thing to say is that Europe and the United States feel like very different worlds. And I say that as someone who's been on both sides of the Atlantic since the pandemic started. If you're in the United States, you feel like you're in this everyday dystopia, and you're right. Whereas if you're in Europe, you have the impression that the authorities more or less understand what's going on, more or less have it under control. And so your daily life is a kind of regular bad, right? There's a regular recession going on. There are regular hygienic measures which are taking place. There's a kind of normality. So one thing which is happening is that the US and Europe are diverging, I think, more than anyone ever really expected. And the divergence isn't just ideological or personal.
Do you think that politics in the United States is starting to understand the gravity of what's happening?
I think beginning to understand is a nice way to put it. It really takes a lot of doing to turn the COVID-19 outbreak into the kind of catastrophe that we have in the United States. And I think we should think about it in terms of active doing rather than just inaction. You had to take a lot of decisions in order to kill so many people. And I do think that in 2020, one difference among the Democrats or among the opponents of Mr. Trump is that there is a sense of the gravity of the situation. In 2016, I was one of the few people who was talking about things like Russian intervention and the drastic consequences of the election of Mr. Trump. In 2020, though, I think the mood is very different. I think people are aware that the country is at a tipping point, that the status quo is no longer tenable, whether we like it or not, and that the country is going to go one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. And then in the pandemic, a lot of what we're seeing is also something that you talk extensively about in your book, the healthcare system. And back in June, you tweeted with regard to your book, "When I was very ill, I learned some things I didn't know about health and freedom." So what was the biggest lesson that you learned from that experience?
When you're in an American hospital, you're always thinking about two things. You're thinking about your own health and you're thinking about money. You're wondering if the nurses and the doctors are making decisions because of you or because of some algorithm which is driving their decisions in some direction because of cost. And I think the main thing that hit me was that commercial medicine is just a bad idea. That our way of doing things is just wrong and that we should start again. We shouldn't be in a situation where people can't afford to go to the hospital. We shouldn't be in a situation where there's silent privilege for some people over others. We shouldn't be in a situation where people who have relatively less bad care are happy because they have relatively less bad care. We should be in a situation where everyone has access to care. And I guess, I mean, personally, it's a simple, banal thing, but I realize that this kills you. This can kill people. I almost died, and I wouldn't have almost died. It wouldn't have even been a close call if I'd been in other countries where I lived before. So that health is a matter of our being freer as a people, but also that health is a matter of just elementary existential questions. I mean, these are the kinds of things which came clear to me.
So from this side of the Atlantic, we've been seeing what's going on in U.S. hospitals, a lot of the things that you were just speaking to. But of course, not everybody in Germany is aware of the difference to the German healthcare system. What are the main differences in our systems apart from the American system being very, very profit-based as compared to in Europe?
the basic difference you've already named, that when you're in the US system, you have this creepy feeling that you're not sure why things are happening. In the German system, where I've also spent some time, you may disagree with some decisions that are being taken. You know, you may, for example, think they should be a little bit earlier to use antibiotics in some situations than they are. Mm. But you don't really doubt that their decisions are being made on the basis of health as opposed to something else. The American system is based, we don't like the word, but it's based on privilege. Whereas the systems here, although they function differently one after the other, fundamentally based on the idea that everyone has the right to be treated.
Obamacare seemed to be kind of a step in the right direction, at least from a European standpoint. Why has it been criticized so sharply in the United States?
I think this has to do with a basic misunderstanding of what freedom is all about. I mean, this is one of the things that came clear to me when I was in the hospital. You know, you're not free if you're dead, and you're not free if you're dying, and you're not free if you have tubes run into your body. You're not free if you're unconscious. You're not free if you're sedated and drugged. You're not free if you can't speak. You know, in other words, you have to be healthy in order to be free, and you have to not be afraid of illness if you're going to be free. In America, though, these concepts of health and freedom, rather than working together, they're opposed to one another. So the way that Americans or Americans on the right or Republicans run the argument is that you can't have healthcare because it will make you less free somehow. Whereas I think that's a fundamental mistake. I think there's no way that Americans are more free when our hospitals are bought up by private equity firms, which then charge us ridiculous fees, which prevent us from getting healthcare. That may make, you know, the children of a few private equity investors freer in their future choices, but it makes the country as a whole less free. I think where we're trapped is that we think there's somehow a clash between these two values, and you have to choose between health and freedom. And the, one of the big arguments I'm trying to make in the book is that that's just wrong. We could open the floodgates, we could have more health, and we could have more freedom, because the two things, in fact, work together.
After seeing what's happened in the pandemic now, and seeing that the American healthcare system has really failed the ultimate test, do you think that anything is going to change as a result?
Yeah, I mean, I watched the pandemic from a peculiar point of view. I mean, like, I knew lots of people who got sick and some people who got very seriously ill. There was illness in my family. I was inside hospitals when the pandemic was going on and, you know, had the experience of being treated by people who were not wearing protective equipment, who really should have been wearing protective equipment. The pandemic, as you say, brought out what some of our basic problems are, that we don't have a public health system, and also that we don't have a welfare state in general. If we had things that other countries have, like sick leave, then the pandemic would have been less of a problem. If we had unemployment compensation, then the pandemic would have been less of a problem. Because we lack the basic structures of a welfare state, an illness becomes this massive social and political crisis. I would like to think that this is going to make a difference. I would like to think that, you know, when Joe Biden talks about the need for a fundamental reform, we can take him seriously. I really think, though, that the change has to be at the level of minds, that we have to think about health as something which is our right, and we have to think of health as a precondition for everything else, because it is. You can't be a parent without health. You can't raise your children without health. You can't deal with your parents, you know, your aging parents, without a healthcare system. And without those things, we can't really talk about being a free country. Of course, The Affordable Care Act was a step in the right direction, but I think we have to think in terms of a system to which everyone has access, regardless of whether they're employed or not. I think that we have to think a little bit more radically.
Do you think that there's any hope for people to make that radical change, or is it too big and unmoving and driven by profit to even have a chance?
I think you identify the problem, which is that there are a few people who make a lot of money from the present situation. And I think we have to formulate that as there are a few people who are making a lot of money from the fact that Americans are sick and die. I think that's how we should see the question. You know, when people use neutral formulations like 20% or so of our gross domestic product is in healthcare, that really shrouds what's going on. It shouldn't be that much. We should be spending less money. I mean, another difference between us and the Germans and other comparable countries is that we spend more on healthcare in order to get less. And so, you know, why do we get less? And where is all that money going. You know, the basic core truth is that you can get better healthcare for less money and feel better about it at the end of the day. You know, you're right to ask how you get from here to there. Part of it is, I think we have to change the way we're talking about it. I think healthcare has to be understood as a right, as a basic reality of life, that without which Americans can't live the American dream. I think another part of it is that we have to accept that not everything is part of the market. So, you know, the market is supposed to work for us. Okay, I like markets in that sense. I think there should be variety. I understand that there's a place in the world for competition and certainly for new ideas. But the problem with healthcare is that that's no longer a market for us. Healthcare is a market of us. It's a market in which we're no longer choosing anything. When you're in an American hospital, you're not making meaningful choices. Choices are being made about your body without your participation. And that means that you're not free. We have to be able to say as Americans that there are some places where the market belongs and other places where the market doesn't belong. And the decision when I'm going to be expelled from a hospital is not a place where market forces should be making the decision. You know, I got expelled from a hospital much sooner than I would have in India or in Bulgaria because market forces matter too much inside American hospitals. So when we are the objects, when we are the widgets, when we are the things that are at the mercy of the market, that's when we're not free. And I think that's a distinction we have to make.
Do you think that there's any aspect of people not believing what they're reading or maybe not wanting to believe that that's actually the case? Do you think that people are rejecting these scientifically proven findings that, for example, that you can have healthcare and freedom at the same time? You don't have to pay as much to get healthcare that's worse than in other countries. Where do we have this rejecting of scientific findings and recommendations and people falling for conspiracy theories now? Where do you think that's coming from?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I would even take a step back and say that in the U.S., there's a strange taboo in talking about hospitals, healthcare, your own health. And I think part of that taboo has to do with the fact that everybody knows that it's a question of privilege. And therefore, people feel uncomfortable talking about it. Everybody knows that somebody else might have gotten a better heart doctor because they're richer. Everybody knows that their neighbor would have gone to the hospital at a time when they couldn't go to the hospital because they couldn't have afforded it. And the present inequality already makes health hard to talk about. I would stress then the next thing for me would be local news. I mean, before we get into the science or the politics or anything, if you don't know that there's mercury in the water, then of course you might think it's a conspiracy or something. You only know if there's a reporter who measures the mercury in the water. And we in the United States have lost the local reporters who, you know, completely non-politically were just doing things like measuring whether there's mercury in the water or not, you know, whether there is actually leakage from that hazardous waste site or not, whether there is dangerous stuff in the Ohio River or in the air. We no longer have the reporters to cover those things. And you know, you'll see where I'm going. When the epidemic began, we didn't have the reporters to tell people, there's this unexpected third wave of flu in the hospitals, which there was, but there weren't reporters. We didn't have people covering the nursing homes as they hid the stacks of bodies. We just didn't have the number of journalists we needed to make the illness real. Even though it was happening, right? It was already happening in January and February, but people were not aware of it. That's a fundamental problem with American democracy, not just with the pandemic, is that people shouldn't be getting their news from Chinese and Russian propaganda over the internet. They shouldn't be getting their news from White House press conferences, regardless of who the president is. They should be getting their news from local people who are actually covering the facts around them. And we've lost that. And that, I think, is what cuts us loose into this world where, you know, people have substituted Facebook for the newspaper, and Facebook tells you what you want to hear, or it trains you into certain kinds of patterns. And then once you've been trained, it's hard for you to get over the first thing that you've heard. So if the first thing that you heard about the pandemic was that it was a hoax, the way humans are, we tend to get defensive about the first thing that we believe. So,
right.
And all of that leaves the president aside, right? I mean, the president, of course, is an X factor. The fact that he is, you know, a human fact destroyer, right? Like he's a black hole of factuality, which takes it in and never releases it again. That is also an independent problem.
So what would you say are the ways we can preserve our freedom and democracy with a view to Election Day coming up in just a few weeks?
Yeah, I guess the first thing is to take the election seriously and everybody go vote. regardless of what your views are, everybody go vote and take this institution seriously, because it's what we've got. And you know, as the founders understood, elections, you know, the regular changeover of personnel are what makes a democracy possible. The fact that we can judge people, the fact that office holders know that they will have to go at a certain point, all those things create the mentality of a democracy, and mentality is really what it's all about. And we have to take it seriously because the present office holder of the office of the President of the United States doesn't take it seriously. He doesn't believe in elections. He likes dictators. So the first thing is we have to take part in the elections. The second thing is we have to be calm. We're not going to know the outcome on election night because there'll be a lot of ballots to be counted. We know the president will reject the results. We know the president's going to make a lot of noise. We can be pretty confident that some of his supporters are going to cause trouble. That has happened before in the U.S. It's happened in other countries all the time. And that doesn't mean that the whole system is falling apart. It does mean that some of us are going to have to protest. It does mean that some of us are going to have to be courageous and defend our institutions. But that's also normal in democracy. Democracy isn't handed to you. So November is going to be a challenge, but it could be a challenge from which we learn things and come out better on the other side.
Let's hope so. And just in closing, I have kind of just a personal question to you as someone who, I'm from upstate New York and I grew up there. I went to school in DC. I've been living in Germany for 13 years now. So I kind of know both sides of it also. And reading your book, you make it pretty clear. And also in this conversation, you make it pretty clear that the American healthcare system is inhumane and broken, and that the system in Europe, for example, allows people to live better and longer and freer. But you still live in the United States. Have you ever contemplated permanently living somewhere else? Or do you see your role as staying there and talking about the issues to try to make them better?
I personally have never thought of leaving the United States for good. I'm glad that I spend time in Europe because it gives me perspective. And of course, I have to because I'm a historian of Europe. So this is what I do. Mm. But I'm an American. And, you know, this book, Our Malady, that we've been talking about, I couldn't write that book about a different country. You know, I mean, it's a book about where I'm from and how I think things have gone wrong. And although I think I like to think I have the objective parts right, it's also a very subjective book. It's a book about it's about American lifespan. You know, I'm 50 now. It's about things that I've seen when I was young and how they've changed for the worse and how I hope they can get better by the time my kids are my age. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's very important when you're from one country to be able to look at another country and say, hey, these people have actually got something right. If you're not capable of doing that, that means you suffer from a serious lack of confidence and you're going to have big problems. So I think it's important for Americans to be able to look at Canada and say, hey, they do some things well there, or look at Germany and say, hey, they do some things well there. And part of the problem with Mr. Trump is that no matter how many things he gets wrong, there's never any question of saying, oh, somebody else got something right. And fundamentally, I mean, part of being a free person is being able to say, hey, I made a mistake, but I could do better.
Yeah. Absolutely. I absolutely agree with you on all of those points. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure talking to you, Tim.
So glad I could do it, Chelsea. Thank you very much.
That's it for today's episode of The Americans. As usual, feel free to send me any feedback at americans@mediapioneer.com. I'm Chelsea Speaker. I'd like to honor Ruth Bader Ginsburg by letting her speak the last words today, and letting us in on her very own sense of humor.
Do you feel that, as a liberal, that conservative women, men, can identify with you as well?
The label liberal or conservative, every time I hear that, I think of the great Gilbert and Sullivan song from Ireland that goes, every gal and every boy that's born alive is either a little liberal or else a little conservative. What do those labels mean? It depends on whose ox is being gored.
Either a little liberal or else a little concern.